We left off in chapter 29 of 1 Samuel last week, after establishing that the story that we're hearing is being told in a flashback style. And so it integrates and overlaps with the narrative of the previous chapter, chapter 28. Now, the flashback concerns the battle camp of the Philistines that is said in chapter 28 to be at Shunem, on the edge of the Jezreel Valley, and the Israelite battle camp that is situated atop Mount Gilboa, not very far from Shunem. And chapter 29 now will inform us that the Philistines first assembled at Aphek, that is on the northern edge of Philistine territory, while Israel used a large spring that was about 5 miles away from the city of Jezreel as an initial meeting point for the clans and for the tribes to gather together for war. Once both armies, both sides, were assembled, then they marched to their respective battle camps, one at Shunem, the other Gilboa. So let's reread this short chapter 29 in 1 Samuel to kind of refresh our memories for tonight. Page 331, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. 331, we're going to read 1 Samuel chapter 29. The Philistines gathered all of their army together at Aphek, while Israel's army pitched camp by the spring of Jezreel. The leaders of the Philistines were passing by with their hundreds and thousands. David and his men were bringing up the rear with Achish. The chiefs of the Philistines asked, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish answered the chiefs of the Philistines, "This is David, who was a servant of Saul, king of Israel. He's been with me now for well over a year. I haven't found anything wrong with him between the time he deserted to me and now." But the chiefs of the Philistines became angry and said to him, "Have the man return and go back to the place you set aside for him. Don't let him go into battle with us, because in the battlefield he might become our enemy. What better way could there be for him to get reconciled with his Lord than by cutting off the heads of our men? This is David. They used to dance and sing about him. Saul has killed his thousands, David his tens of thousands." So Achish summoned David and said to him, "As Adonai lives, you have been upright. I myself would be more than pleased to have you go on campaign with me, because I haven't found anything wrong with you between the day you arrived and now. However, the chiefs don't trust you. Therefore, now go back. Go in peace, so as not to do what appears bad to the chiefs of the Philistines." And David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant during the time I've been with you that disqualifies me from going and fighting against the enemies of my lord the king?" And Achish answered David, I know that you are as good from my point of view as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the chiefs of the Philistines have said he's not to go up with us to the battlefield. So get up early in the morning with the servants of your lord who came with you, and as soon as you're up and it gets light, leave." David got up early in the morning, he and his men, to leave and go back to the land of the Philistines, while the Philistines continued on up to Jezreel. Well, the circumstances are that as the armies of the five Philistine kings were arriving at Aphek, David and his men showed up, bringing up the rear as part of Achish's contingent. Now, four of the Philistine kings, Achish representing the fifth, they were surprised, not the least bit happy, to find David and his army there. Now, obviously, they were well aware of the alliance that Achish had formed with David and Achish's contentment with David and his men and their families living in his territory. But common sense told them that to have the Hebrew David and his men participating in a war against their own countrymen, regardless of all the political difficulties that David was having with Saul that forced him into this self-imposed exile, it was too risky to allow such a thing. Achish was so firmly convinced of David's dependability and is equally convinced that David had severed all loyalties with Israel in general due to his raiding of Judahite settlements in the Negev, that he defended David's expectation of involvement in this upcoming battle. King Achish said that he'd been dealing with David for nearly a year and a half, and that David had proved to to be nothing but trustworthy. Well, verse 4 has four Philistine kings confronting Achish, telling him to send David back to Ziklag, because it was highly likely that once this battle started, David was going to turn on the Philistines as a means of getting back into the good graces of the Israelites. Now, most versions say something to the effect that David would revert to becoming an enemy or an adversary of the Philistines. The Hebrew word that's being translated as enemy or adversary is a familiar one to us. Satan. That's right. Here the accusation is that David would become the Satan, the Satan, of Philistia. And despite the reality that we tend to use Satan, Satan, as a formal name for the devil, in fact, it's only a common Hebrew term that means adversary. And here we see a good example of what an adversary, a Satan, does in the eyes of the ancients. First and foremost, a Satan, a Satan, is a traitor. Second of all, a Satan will fight against his former ally and king. And third, that even though he might feign loyalty, the words are hollow, because a Satan is a liar by nature. These are pretty good things to remember about the attributes of the evil one whom we call Satan. Well, the Philistine kings pled with Achish to come to his senses. Remember that a leopard doesn't change his spots so easily. This is David, they remind him. This is the guy who is such a fierce warrior and is able to gain the loyalty of his troops to such a degree that the Hebrew women wrote songs about him. Songs that made him 10 times greater in their eyes than the king of Israel. Achish saw there was no point arguing the matter further, so he turned to David and he told him the bad news. Now, Achish was utterly apologetic. He acknowledges how upright, how truthful David has been, and he would have been greatly pleased to have David fight side by side with him in battle. But alas, the other Philistine lords were going to have none of it. They didn't trust David. So David would have to take his men and go back to Ziklag. Well, in verse 6, Achish is so emotional about having to tell David of this decision that he even invokes the name of David's Israelite God when he says, "As Jehovah lives, you have been upright." See, this was undoubtedly an act of the greatest courtesy and deference towards David. But in verse 8, perhaps we ought to be surprised to find that David actually tried to change Achish's mind. He says he's astonished. He's confounded because he can't imagine what he's done to deserve this treatment, this distrust. And he asks, what is it about him that Achish finds suspicious that he won't allow David to fight against the enemies of my lord the king? Well, many Jewish and Christian scholars refuse to see David's statement as anything but deception. In fact, many say that this reference to my lord the king was intentionally ambiguous. That David could have been referring to Saul, King Saul. Now, I have to tell you, I don't see anything that substantiates that point of view. David certainly intended to fight for Achish and against Saul's forces. Now, what would David have done had he come face to face with King Saul? It's open for debate. But for sure, David would have had no problem killing Saul's soldiers, Hebrew or not. Notice that nothing has been recorded that David was up to now plotting to suddenly at the right moment turn on the Philistines who had befriended him and saved him from Saul. So Achish instructed David to finish out the night at the Philistine encampment in Aphek, but in the morning he was to get up and head back to Ziklag. David complied. David was once again saved from himself by God's providence. It's hard to say how David would have reacted once the battle against his own brethren began. It's also doubtful that all of David's men would have joined him. I mean, certainly some unknown number of David's troops could not have brought themselves to spill the blood of their extended family members for the sake of the Philistines' ambitions. See, it was one thing to raid Judean villages for profit and for sustenance, and they took animals and food and valuable goods, but it's quite another to fight against their hereditary nation on behalf of their enemy. David was in deep. I mean, he had made himself a pariah in the eyes of his own tribe, Judah, and his own nation, Israel, due to his association with Achish, his plundering of his own people. At the same time, he was relying on the Philistines to keep him safe from King Saul. Should he fight against the man he steadfastly acknowledged as God's anointed king? Or should he turn against the king of God, King Achish, who had showed David such grace and hospitality and trust? It seems like in this situation, no matter which way he chose to proceed, he would have had blood on his hands, sit on his head. Of course, this no-win dilemma was as the result of a whole series of less than, shall we say, admirable decisions on his part, and of David's penchant for lying, for deceit, for self-preservation at any cost. But God had great plans for David, and so as only Jehovah can, he invisibly and unexpectedly intervened, and David was miraculously relieved of having to choose between fighting Israelites and fighting Achish. But that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be terrible consequences for his choices and for his actions. Well, let's move on to chapter 30. Open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 30, still on page 331. Read along with me, please. Three days later, when David and his men arrived back in Ziklag, they found that the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag. They had sacked Ziklag, burned it down. They had taken captive the women, everyone there, great and small. They hadn't killed anyone, but had carried them off as they went on their own way. So when David and his men arrived at the city, there it was, burned down, with their wives, sons, daughters taken captive. Then David and the people with him cried aloud until they had no more power to cry. David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam from Yisrael and Abigail, the widow of Nabal from Carmel. David was in serious trouble. The people were talking about stoning him to death because all the people were in such deep grief, each man over his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself and Adonai his God. And David said to Abiatar the Kohen, the priest, the son of Ahimelech, "Please bring the ritual vest to me." Abiatar brought the vest to David. Then David consulted Adonai. He asked, "Should I go in pursuit of these raiders? Will I catch up with them?" And Adonai answered him, "Go in pursuit, because you will overtake them and recover everyone and everything." So David went, he and the 600 men with him. They came to Wadi Bashor, where those who were to stay behind waited. Then David continued in pursuit with 400 men, while 200, too exhausted to cross Wadi Bashor, stayed behind. Now they found an Egyptian in the countryside, and they brought him to David. They gave him some bread to eat and water to drink. They also gave him a lump of dried figs and two bunches of raisins. And after eating, he revived, because he hadn't eaten anything or drunk any water for 3 days and nights. And David asked him, "To whom do you belong? Where are you from?" And he answered, "I'm an Egyptian boy, the slave of an Amalekite. My master abandoned me 3 days ago because I got sick. We raided the Negev of the Kriti, the Negev of Judah, and the Negev of Caleb, and we burned down Ziklag." And David answered him, "Will you lead me down to this raiding party? He said, if you will swear by God to me that you won't kill me or hand me back to my master, I'll lead you down to the raiders. Well, he led them down, and there they were, spread out all over the ground, eating, drinking, celebrating how much spoil they'd taken from the territory of the Philistines and the territory of Judah. David attacked them from dawn until evening the next day. Not one of them escaped, except for 400 young men who jumped on camels and got away. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken. He also rescued his two wives. They found nothing missing, big or little. Not sons, not daughters, not plundered goods, or anything else they had taken. David brought it all back. David took all the flocks and herds and drove them ahead of their own livestock, announcing, "This is David's spoil." When David came to where the 200 men were who had been too exhausted to follow him, whom they had let stay at Wadi Beshor, they came out to meet David and the people with him. And when David approached them, he greeted them. But some of the men who had gone with David were evil men, scoundrels. They said, "They didn't go with us. We're not giving them any of the property we recovered. Each man can take his wife and his children. Leave." And David said, "No. No, my brothers, don't do this with the goods Adonai has given us. He protected us. He handed the raiding party over to us. Anyhow, no one agrees with you about this. No, the share of someone who stays with the equipment will be the share, the same as the share of someone who goes out and fights. They will share equally. And it's been that way from that day on. He established it as a ruling for Israel to this day." And when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the leaders of Judah, who were his friends, with a note. "Here's a present for you from the spoils of the enemy of Adonai." And he sent such gifts to those in Beit El, to those in Ramoth, to those in Yatir, to those in Aroer, to those in Sifmot, to those in Eshtemoa, to those in Rakal, to those in Yerach Mieli, to those in the cities of the Canaanites, to those in Hormah, to those in Kor Ashan, to those in Atak, to those in Hebron, and to all the places where David and his men had frequently visited. Well, 3 days after being dismissed by King Achish, David and his men were horrified when they returned to the burnt-to-the-ground Ziklag. Nothing was left. All the women and children were missing. The Amalekites had come. While David and his men were marching with Achish, they'd ransacked the village. No doubt the Amalekites had been waiting for just this opportunity for revenge after what David had been doing to them for the past year or so with all of his raiding. Verse 2 makes the point of saying that the Amalekites hadn't killed anyone, but rather they'd only carried them off. Now, at first blush, that seems a little bit odd, considering that David's methods of attacking the Amalekite people was to plunder them and then kill everybody, adults, male and female, so that Achish couldn't find out anything from them about David's tactics or the amount of booty that he was confiscating. Why wouldn't the Amalekites simply slaughter all of David's people as payback? Was it a kindness of sorts to just kidnap them? Simply put, the Amalekites needed to replenish their tribe since David had killed off so many of them. And it was, and it continues to be, common in tribal societies for one tribe to steal people from another tribe as a means of building up their own tribe. The payback was that the Amalekites were stealing the women from the very men who killed all the Amalekite women. Now, naturally, David and his men were devastated. Their wives, their children were gone, taken away by God's number one earthly enemy, Amalek. In the sad irony and all of this is that had King Saul or any of the prior Israelite leaders, had they followed God's instructions to exterminate the Amalekites down to the last one, this never would have occurred. The first mention of the Eternal Order to destroy Amalek came all the way back in Moses' day. Amalek was the first, if you'll recall, to try to destroy Israel. And it happened almost immediately after Israel was redeemed. They had just left Egypt. They hadn't even reached Mount Sinai yet when Amalek attacked them. Remember back to Deuteronomy 25 and 17 through 19. Remember what Amalek did to you on the road as you were coming out of Egypt. How he met you by the road, attacked those in the rear, those who were exhausted, straggling behind when you were so tired and weary. He didn't fear God. Therefore, when Adonai your God has given you rest from all of your surrounding enemies in the land, Adonai your God is giving you as your inheritance to possess, you're to blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Don't forget. But nearly 400 years later, in David and Saul's time, God had not forgotten. Even though Israel now had other enemies that they were more concerned with, and thus they had some decided ambivalence towards this commandment. 1 Samuel 15. Samuel said to Saul, Adonai sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now listen to what Adonai has to say. Here is what Adonai Sabaoth says. I remember what Amalek did to Israel, how they fought against Israel when they were coming up out of Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and completely destroy everything they have. Don't spare them. Kill the women and children. Babies, cows, sheep, camels, and donkeys. See, this is the way of humans. This is the way of men. We believe that as time passes and as society and culture evolves, the older ways automatically become irrelevant. So we're not beholden to them any longer. This is probably why the Bible takes every opportunity to remind us that while we might change and the world might change, God never does. Yeah, I'm a little heartsick and distressed and probably a bit angry that many Jews and Christians alike have decided that in hindsight, it was wrong, it was barbarian of God to order this enemy, Amalek, annihilated, or anybody else for that matter. And that our Savior has decided that we need to go another way and ignore what the Father commanded us to do. It is Amalek's descendants who continue to this day to want to destroy Israel. And yet many believe we need to see them as the victims, to show them mercy, support even, in God's name. Can you imagine? Amalek lives on in spirit and in flesh. We've talked about the spirit of Amalek in prior lessons, and it's a controversial subject because as believers, we don't like to face the realities and consequences of it. In a nutshell, the spirit of Amalek is alive and well in all of those who oppose Israel and God's people, the Hebrews. Those who are anti-Semitic are Amalek. I'm not speaking about an opposition to some of the Israeli government's political or social policies. That's not what I mean. Or at the disgust of some of the ultra-Orthodox's radical and unkind behavior. Or to the endemic and politically correct Israeli Jewish persecution of Jewish believers. This isn't about a blanket approval of all things Jewish, of all Jewish individuals, or that they're beyond criticism. Rather, I'm talking about a fundamental bent of most of humanity to stand with Israel's enemies against Israel. I'm speaking of a philosophical belief, a geopolitical decision that Israel is entitled to no more land than what the world decides they ought to have. I'm speaking about a denial that the Hebrews and the land of Israel are set apart for God, and an erroneous belief that that set apart land no longer belongs only to the set apart people. The purpose of Armageddon is essentially so that our returning Messiah will finally do what all of Israel's leaders had been charged to do since the time of Joshua. But they didn't do it. Why? It was because of their own self-defined sense of justice that was effectively in opposition to God's sense of justice. It is also because those who today stand in sympathy with the Arab and Muslim world against Israel harbor that spirit of Amalek. And while I'm not advocating the execution of these people in our day, I am saying that those who have this attitude against Israel and the Jewish people stand in direct opposition to God, and they have chosen to be in harmony with Amalek. And I'm going to say it as loudly and as strongly as I know how, that if you have an association with a church or a synagogue where the leadership harbors this attitude and advocates it, get out of there. You don't belong there. It's malicious, it's deadly, it's as contagious. Well, it's a spiritual virus, it's what it is. A very deadly one. You don't belong there. Stay away from it. This is the same deadly spiritual virus that had now attacked the future king of Israel, David. That had carried off his wives, the wives and children of all of his followers. David's men were so bitter, they figured David needs to be stoned. Well, somebody's got to get it. I mean, did David deserve some blame for this? You bet he did. It was his lying, his deception, his trying to play both sides of the fence at the same time that put him and his whole community of followers in this bad situation. While David was allying himself with the enemy and leading his men off on a junket to fight against God's set-apart people, guess what happened? The enemy stealthily came in and stole away their families. Let those who have an ear to hear listen to this. But David's men couldn't justifiably lay all the fault at David's feet. They had chosen to follow him. They weren't captives. They weren't slaves. They weren't going to be killed if they tried to leave. Fortunately, some common sense prevailed, and once the men calmed down, they realized that killing David wasn't the answer to the problem. So what were they going to do? Well, again, they looked to their leader, David, and David, still maintaining that heart for God, despite all of his imperfections, he knew that he needed to look to his leader for answers. His leader, who is the God of Israel. And verse 6 says that David strengthened himself in Yahweh. Now here's a pattern for us to remember, and we need to take it to heart. When in times of greatest distress, greatest danger, the first thing to do before we act is to bring the matter before the Lord. The first thing. Unfortunately, often that's the second thing we do. First, we act out in our own strength. Then we make everything worse. Then we go see God to straighten it all out. I've never done that. I'm sure my wife is laughing her head off right now at that. David called for the high priest Abiathar so that the Urim and Tumim stones that were stored in the high priest's ephod, that little pouch, could be used to determine what God's will was in this issue. Abiathar was the offspring of Abimelech, the high priest of Nob. I realize that no mention is made of the Urim and Tumim specifically in this passage, but it's self-evident that the two divine stones were the means of communication with God in this particular instance. David made a series of inquiries to the Lord. The first was the most basic question of all. Should he go after the Amalekites who stole their women and children? To this, God answered in the affirmative. The next question was whether they would catch up with them. And the answer was that not only would they catch up to them, they'd recover everyone and everything. There's an interesting and I think intentional contrast here to the result of David seeking God's oracle and that of Saul's attempt to do just the same a couple of chapters ago. Here, God readily responds to David. But he gave only silent condemnation to any of King Saul's overtures. And this is because, as we've been told earlier, God was with David, but he was no longer with Saul. Now, let me point out that the editor of 1 Samuel has formulated the words written down as God's response to David, but they weren't actually spoken by God. Now, we can know that for a couple of reasons. First, the Lord did not speak directly to David like he did with Moses and a lesser degree to the prophets. Second of all, the Urim and Tumim stones could only give binary answers. In other words, yes or no, right or left, up or down, one or the other. That's all it could do. The addition of this line of dialogue is merely to make the story more memorable, exciting, and the essence of it's completely accurate. David asked these questions in some form, and to them God answered yes. Strengthened that the outcome was already determined and that it was going to be a good outcome, David gathers up his 600 men. They head south now to intercept these marauding Amalekites who had kidnapped their families. Well, after they traveled about 25 miles, they came to a wadi, dry river bed. They decided to rest for a short time. And 200 of David's men said they were just too exhausted to go on any further. Now we have to remember that within the last several days, they had marched from Ziklag to Aphek, then after one night's rest, marched back to Ziklag, which we're told is a 3 days journey, each direction. Then they arrived home tired, in need of food. There was no village. There was no food. Almost immediately now, they formed up and they hurried south, at least 2 days, long journey, till they finally arrived at the Wadi Bashor, and there the weaker ones just couldn't go on anymore. Thus, David left 200 of them at the Wadi and went on with the 400 hardier men. Well, David's band of men followed the likely trail of the Amalekite raiders, and they stumbled across an Egyptian boy who out there in the desert wilderness. He was sick. He hadn't eaten, he said, for 3 days. And as much as in order to try and get crucial information as to show some kindness and compassion, the boy's given some food, some water, and he revives. He explains that he was indeed part of that Amalekite raiding party that had been plundering the Negev. He was a slave, so he had been forced to be a part of this group against his will. However, as the Amalekites were fleeing the area, he had come down ill. So they abandoned him out in the desert to die. Now, interestingly, this boy's confession explains that the Amalekites had attacked both Philistine and Israelite villages. And in verse 13, where it says that they had raided the Negev of the Kriti, meaning the Cherethites, it is actually referring either to the Philistines or at least to their ethnic cousins. And we find evidence of this in a couple of other places in the Bible. In Ezekiel 25:16, it says, "Therefore, Adonai Elohim says, I'll stretch out my hand over the Philistines, eliminate the Kriti, and destroy the rest of the seacoast peoples." Zephaniah 2:5 says, "Woe to you inhabitants of the seacoast, the nation of the Kriti. The word of Adonai is against you, Canaan, land of the Philistines. I'll destroy you. No one will be left." Well, the Hebrew word here seems to be referring to Crete, the island of Crete, where it is generally thought that the Philistines had originated from. The Amalekites also plundered the area around Hebron, the also called the Negev of Caleb, and then the southern parts of Judah. They were equal opportunity desert pirates. They didn't much care whose goods they stole. So what we can understand is that as much as Amalek was the hated enemy of Israel, they were also not much, they didn't have much friendship towards the Philistines. And David asked this unnamed Egyptian boy if he could possibly lead David's men to the Amalekites. And the boy responded that if David promised not to punish him or give him back to his Amalekite masters, yeah, he could do that. Well, the boy's true to his word. And verse 16, as David coming upon a group of drunken Amalekites just sprawled all over the desert floor and celebrating their profitable foray into the Negev. Well, the angry and by now very hardened army of David had little problem in decimating the unprepared and bleary-eyed Amalekites. No Amalekite had a weapon in his hand. Apparently no watch had been set up. So what came next was a total surprise. And David waited until they had succumbed to the wine and fell asleep, and he attacked them at dawn. We're told the fighting went on until nearly sunset, and the only surviving Amalekites were those who had been tending the camels. This means they would have been young boys. We're told that 400 escaped by riding away on those camels. Now, this ought to give us a sense of the size of this war party. This was a big group, probably at least 1,000 people, maybe more. So this must have been quite a scene going on here. And the victorious David rescued every last woman and child, all the goods and animals that had been stolen from him. Now, I can't even imagine what a joyous evening of reunion and relief that must have been. In addition to recovering their own goods, David's men also took all that the Amalekites had taken from other locations. David claimed it all as his own, although I'm not so sure that was the proper thing to do. Back in chapter 15, the instruction to Saul was to attack Amalek and destroy everything, right down to the cattle. This was more of a standing order to all Israelite leaders than it was a one-time instruction just for Saul. Now, considering that David had consulted Jehovah and that he was given the instruction to go after Amalek, boy, this smacks of holy war. And the spoils of holy war belong to God. No doubt much of what David's men retrieved from the Amalekite camp was classified as recovery of property, their own property, not spoils of war. And the Lord wouldn't have had any issue with it, what they came back with, their own property. But what David took, that was spoils of war. Well, as this happy band began their trek back north, they retraced their route so that they could join back up with that group of 200 they'd left up the Wadi Bashor. And we read in verse 21 that the men saw David coming and they went to meet him, and then David asked after their peace. And the Complete Jewish Bible says that David greeted them, but it was more than a mere hello, as the Hebrew word sha'al would indicate. Sha'al means to inquire. It means David was asking about their well-being as a concerned shepherd would. I suspect the two groups meeting up again was kind of tense, a little uncomfortable. After all, many of the women and children who were recovered belonged to that group of 200 stayed behind. The 400 had risked their lives for the sakes of all, while the 200 had stayed back, resting safely at the Wadi. Now, I think David sensed this wasn't going to go well, so he kind of tried to smooth things over a little bit. And sure enough, several of the 400 who had rescued the women and children and their belongings felt the 200 didn't deserve anything that was recovered other than get their families back. And the Bible describes the men who had that attitude as raw and Belial, evil and worthless. But David's crusader side emerges now, as he essentially cites the Musketeer Creed. All for one and one for all. He explains that the Lord gave them this victory over the Amalekites so the plunder should be evenly divided among the members of the congregation. Those who went to fight, with those who, due to the physical exhaustion, had to stay behind. In my mind, this lends even more credence to the possibility that in reality, this was a holy war venture, in God's eyes anyway, and that David had no business accepting that Amalekite plunder as his own prize. That said, we should notice that what the evil and the worthless men, the raw and the Belial, what they weren't suggesting was so much as dividing the goods taken from the Amalekites into 400 shares instead of 600. Rather, it was that the only recovery that the 200 should get was their families. They shouldn't even receive the food, the animals, the other items that even belonged to them before the Amalekites got to it. After all, it is made clear that David took charge of all that belonged to the Amalekites, meaning everything that was above and beyond the band's own recovered possessions. And in the end, David made sure that each family member got whatever was recovered and belonged to them originally. This incident became infamous and even became almost like case law. It set a precedent as to how such matters ought to be addressed. Actually, the Hebrew words say it became a chok and a mishpat, an ordinance and a judgment. In other words, as the word mishpat implies, this ruling of David's was seen as appropriate justice. And so it actually became part of the Israelite legal code that had to be followed or there would be a penalty. We're going to stop here for tonight and we're going to finish up this chapter next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.